everyone. I am Nase DeSanders, and I am here with the writer-director of Silence and Darkness, Barak Barhan. Silence and Darkness is a 2020 drama and thriller about two sisters, one blind and one deaf, who come to realize their father may be a source of danger instead of safety. Welcome, Barak.
Thank you. I like your description.
I'm glad. So let's jump in. This was your first feature film. Congratulations. For the aspiring filmmakers tuning in, can you tell us something that you learned on this project?
Oh, so much. Like you said, it's my first feature film. And I think, you know, what you really learn is trying to figure out how to tell a story over the length of, you know, 75, 80, 90 minutes. And then I think a big thing also that you do in every scene and also in shorts, but in this film in particular, what I learned a lot was introducing the space to the audience. Mm-hmm. So the house, the yard, the town, and kind of like building that out and revealing that and making sure that the viewer is never really confused as to where we are at any given moment. Wherein I think in shorts, you're telling a very contained story that normally takes, at least my shorts, kind of normally took place really in one place, mostly either in an apartment or a single room. And here, because so much of the story unfolds in and around the house, then there was this notion of having to also establish the geography of where, you know, where they sleep and, you know, where father sleeps and where they hang out, like just kind of orienting the space.
Mm. Okay, yeah,
so that's something I
think a lot of people wouldn't think of. That is definitely important.
Yeah.
So for both your main actors, Nina Walker and Joan Glacken, this was also their first feature film. How was it working with newer actors?
Amazing. I mean, they're both pretty experienced, even though, yeah, it was their first feature film, but they've done plenty of projects beforehand, and they're just, you know, incredibly talented. And I mean, that's it. All I could hope for, and it just made my job easier casting them.
That sounds great. So definitely the way the two sisters interact is one of the most interesting things to see early on in the film. Do you know a blind deaf duo in real life? How did you go about writing them?
So personally, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I do have friends and family who are either blind or hard of hearing, or but not people that necessarily interact with each other. As far as how we went about it, I mean, again, the story I built it out, and then, but in terms of their interaction, that was, you know, we invented this language. Mm-hmm. And then after I'd written the script, I delved further into research and found that these two women who are both deafblind, and they created a language, I think around 2012 or 2013, called ProTactile, which was, they called it a language that reflects their culture and community, which I loved about, I love that. And they have a vlog that you can follow along, and they speak to each other, and there's text that we can all follow along. And one thing that I took from that after, you know, and again, when I say we invented, it was very much Minna and Joan. You know, I had the idea of that this would be a language based on physical contact. I had the idea of how I wanted it to look. And then we went through the script and went through the actual dialogue, and they just kind of took it and ran with it and kind of made it into their own. But one thing I really love about these two women who invented the ProTactile language was the notion of affirmation from the listener. So when the person is talking, the person listening is constantly tapping them on, you know, shoulder, leg, whatever, and kind of affirming that, yes, I'm with you. Yes, I'm in this conversation. So I love that. And I said, okay, that's the one thing we should kind of steal and use, because I like this idea that, you know, you guys are talking to each other, but, you know, we want this dialogue to be dynamic and engaging. And so that was something that made a lot of sense to me too.
Yeah,
so
it's like, really right, interesting. And definitely throughout the film, I was thinking, because obviously this isn't something that on the day-to-day I would normally think of. So seeing it in the film, when they interact, I'm like, oh, that makes sense. Oh, that makes sense. Oh, of course that makes sense.
Right. And then again, you know, it was both just for me, engaging as a subject matter in so many different ways, but then, you know, also from the storytelling point of view was something that I was very excited about trying to use to create tension through the viewer not knowing what they were saying to each other and kind of only having to piece it together when you see the action that precedes it. Mm-hmm. So you see them talking and then you see them doing something. So yeah. Kind of you can say, okay, so they're doing this. Then I guess this was the discussion happening beforehand. And when you build that out throughout the film, hopefully the idea was to kind of, you know, as things get weirder, then you're kind of more engaged into, wait, what are they saying? Yeah. And then, so what are they going to do?
Yeah. No, I definitely like that it wasn't spoon-fed with subtitles underneath the whole time.
Right, exactly. And even in ASL, we didn't give subtitles for when characters were speaking in ASL.
Yeah.
You know, it's very much a movie that says, you know, you either know it or you don't know it. And if you don't know it, hopefully it doesn't take you out of it. It just gets you more engaged into what's happening on the screen and gets you focused.
Definitely. So the father character studies his daughter's like specimens almost, while we as audience members, essentially just because of that, you know, movie audience dynamic, we're doing the same thing. Was this an intentional parallel? And if so, why was it important to include?
I mean, definitely intentional. Again, I think I don't like giving away too much about the father. I'll say, you know, when writing and figuring out what this story is, essentially they live in his worldview. Mm-hmm. The entire construction of how Anna and Beth live is based off of the father's worldview. Now, I know what his worldview is. Mm-hmm. And then I just decided that, you know, I want to throw the audience into this world and not give them all the answers and kind of sprinkle breadcrumbs throughout. And again, it's a risk. And I know we're used to telling stories in a certain way, but I love films that kind of sometimes tend to challenge that. And again, like you said, it was my first film. We made it on an extremely low budget. So I kind of allowed myself to take these creative risks. So anyway, the whole idea of them living under his worldview, I think it feeds into both the how the narrative unfolds and then also in terms of just the various themes that, you know, we were kind of exploring in this movie.
That's very interesting. So films almost never stay the same from writing to directing to editing. Did the film turn out exactly how you pictured when you were writing it? And if not, how was it altered?
So not exactly, obviously. What I learned a lot is, you know, this is a slow film for sure, but it was even, there were versions that were even slower. I'll say that. And you kind of figure out, okay, the pacing here has to pick up at certain points. There's only so much that you can see these two girls hanging out in a house. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, you know, it remained the same, the plot wise and all the different turning points, those kind of came at the beats that similar that were on the page. There were again, little things. And again, the actors, they bring both a whole new texture when you're seeing it unfold and then also coming up with ideas. And there were definitely there were moments I would say that were improvised in the sense that they weren't on the script, but we would think like, okay, we're missing something here. And sit with the actors and kind of figure out what we could do to kind of cement certain moments in the movie and then just shoot it. So
that's super cool. So what was it like working with cinematographer Omar Nasir on the film's look?
Oh my God. Omar's amazing. He's a true genius. I've worked with him on short films. He was either a gaffer and then a cinematographer on my thesis film in film school. And you know, we just have that rapport, and he's just one of those people that is able to do so much with so little, which I think that's what this whole movie is. We were, you know, a 5-person crew on this shoot. I mean, he was a one man. Everybody was a one person department head, you know, running the entire. So he's the entire camera department of the film. Although Pablo, who is also a producer, was a great gaffer as well. But anyway, I think that the great strength that he has is manipulating natural light and utilizing natural light to its fullest. So when you're on such limited resources and you're shooting an entire film with three lights, two of which he built himself from, you know, materials that he went and bought at Home Depot, is pretty incredible, and just shows, you know, the level of talent that he has of just maximizing and creating this look. And then again, you know, the process in terms of staging and composition, that was me and him going through every line of the script, putting together an entire shot list, and then we storyboarded the entire film. So we had the storyboards on set with us every day, and we were able to just kind of, if there was ever any confusion, we were able to just look at the storyboards and go, that's the shot. Like, you know, that's what it looks like. And so it saved the whole conversation.
So how long did shooting take?
18 days. Wow. It was, you know, 6 days on, 1 day off. I think maybe there was some kind of mixture in there in the middle, but 18 day shoot.
Wow. That is quick.
Yeah, no. And, but we had, again, you know, plenty of time. And I think for those that hopefully watch the film, you know, it's one of these films where they're, you know, you hang on for takes for a very long time. And it's not that we didn't shoot coverage, but, you know, it was definitely one of these decisions of, we want to focus on the one shot that tells the story of the scene, mm-hmm. And not shoot 15 different angles.
Yeah.
So we had a lot of time. I felt like I had a lot of time to just, you know, play and have fun and, you know, really delve into performances. Once we had our frame, we said, okay, we know what the one to two, maybe three angles are of the scene. The only scene where you get real coverage is, or, you know, dinner scenes where, you know, those are just any director, I think, you know, just love hates shooting those. Because, you know, you're just covering all the different eye lines all the time and making sure that you're going to be able to cut from one person to the other and not have it feel strange.
Yeah. Nice. So the film was shot in Vermont. How was shooting up there? It didn't seem very cold. So were you shooting in summer?
Shot in spring, which is mud season there. We shot in central Vermont, Mad River Valley. It's this tiny little, it's just like this beautiful little hidden spot. In the middle of Vermont, most people, I think, go to Burlington or go to different places kind of more in the south. But this place is just unbelievable. I've shot a few projects up there. So it was great to get to shoot a movie up there. Yeah, I mean, as far as weather, overall, I think the actors would say that it was cold. I think there was a lot of me making them go out in the kind of cold, wet grass in the backyard. It might have been warm then, but then, you know, it just rained before. So, but overall, I think we were lucky. I think there were moments, there were 3 days where there was a cloud hanging over the house, and literally you went out the driveway and it wasn't raining. But once you came into the, you know, where we were filming, it was raining. And I was just like, great. It's the production cloud is upon us, and we just had to wait for it to pass. But again, for the most part, we, you know, we were utilizing, the weather, I think, to our advantage.
Mm-hmm. Great. So which films or directors have influenced you as a filmmaker, but also the film Silence and Darkness?
So many, all of them. I think as far as just in general, it's very hard for me to separate also the films from the process of the filmmakers, and I kind of appreciate both equally. Mm-hmm. So the list that I've been rattling off are Kubrick, obviously, Yorgos Lanthimos. I think it's, you know, those influences are pretty clear.
Yes, especially in the beginning. I was like, okay.
Yeah. And then also Lynn Ramsey. She's just a master of tone. And I grew up in Israel and both, you know, exposed to American cinema and then also European cinema. So I love, Coppola is another huge influence, but then there's Emir Kusturica and Francois Ozon, who those are filmmakers that I think at an early age, I watched their films, and those are films that, you know, kind of made me go like, oh, you can do anything in movies, and watching their films and not knowing how they're going to end, which is what I love.
Aww. That's awesome. So do you have any upcoming projects you'd like to tell us about?
I can't really get into too many specifics. Mm-hmm. I've been here in Israel for almost a year and have been developing a miniseries with a writing partner of mine. And, you know, those, again, everything is moving so slow, you know, with COVID. So hopefully vaccines are distributed quickly and handily, and that they work, and we can all get back to normal. And then I do have another feature that I've written and would love to get it made. It's set in New York. I'd love to get back to New York and film there. So yes, hopefully those happen.
Awesome. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you. Thank you, Nase. I appreciate it. And good luck with your films. I know that you're also a filmmaker.
Oh, thank you. I need it.
I'm excited to see your films.